Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
We talk a lot about all the variety of ETFs that are out there, but we haven't talked about how to put all those things together.
Yeah, I mean, the ETFs are like the ingredients. You throw them together and you have a dish, and that's called the portfolio. And how do you do that? That's a big open-ended question for a lot of people.
I love that we're already talking about food, because really, this episode is going to be a little bit about recipes.
Oh, God. All right. You can't eat yet, okay?
But
it's like
hungry.
3 hours to lunch.
Come on, let me have some food. But joining us today is a guy named Dan Egan, who works at Betterment. Betterment, Eric, you know a lot about this, is a robo-advisor.
Yeah, so robo-advisors, they use ETFs to build portfolios, and what they do is they get, you know, they ask you a couple questions, you fill it out, they determine your risk tolerance, and boom, you're in a portfolio of, say, 4 to 10 ETFs. They charge you 25 basis points, which is more than half as cheap as an average advisor. They do some rebalancing, some tax loss harvesting, and there's no minimum. So robo-advisors are very popular with millennials and people just getting started who don't have other sort of life things and buildup of wealth that requires maybe more of a human touch, although Betterment's starting to do that too. But the thing about Dan is he does that, so he puts the portfolios together, but he also does a lot with behavior.
And Betterment exclusively uses ETFs.
Yeah, so Dan, part of his job and the company as a whole is to go through the ETFs and decide which ones we want to use and in what percentage to make this portfolio, aka the dish.
By the way, this week, Eric, me, and our producer, Jordan, went on the road down to Betterment's office. So you're going to hear a little bit of an office vibe at this episode because we took the show on the road.
That's code for not great audio.
So enjoy anyway. This week on Trillions, meet a master chef. So we're here at Betterment with Dan Egan.
Hello.
Hi, Dan. Who are you?
So I am the director of behavioral finance and investing at Betterment. Betterment is what we're called a robo-advisor. So we're a predominantly online financial advisor and investment manager. We were the original. So we started taking client money back in 2010. So yeah, we're actually getting to be old and tenured.
So a lot of times people will associate robo-advisors as a disruptor. Mm-hmm. What are you disrupting? Talk about the traditional advisor and how you're different and why this is catching on.
A lot of the time, the seeds of our own destruction in business are sown by choices that we make or choose to not make. And I think if you go back to when Betterment was founded, it was right after the financial crisis. And there was a lot of lack of faith about there being good financial advice being distributed. It was high cost, despite the fact that a lot of it was pretty consistent and systematizable. People had gotten comfortable with the internet. So I think if you went back in time, you could say, actually, a lot of the established players very much could have done this themselves, but it would have meant cannibalizing revenues and a really big IT investment.
So let's talk about that user experience. So when someone comes to the Betterment.com website, where do you go from there?
So I think the first most important thing is that we need to make it easy for a wide variety of people to get to the point where they understand what Betterment is doing for them. And that involves allowing the client to both see how we believe we add value, so focusing them on, we're going to build you a diversified portfolio. We're going to recommend risk level and allow you to have multiple portfolios depending upon the goal that you're investing for. And we're going to talk about the value to you in terms of tax efficiency or getting your time back or getting a better financial plan set up for yourself. That experience is really dependent upon the customer and how they choose to interact with us. So we sometimes have what's interesting is how much selling we really don't do on the website. I would say it's some very large percentage of our clients show up, spend no time on any of our marketing pages. They've heard about us through a friend or through some other sort of medium where they say, I'm in. And they hit our website, they open an account, and all of a sudden there's $100,000 coming in the next week.
So why use a robo solution at all?
Yeah, and let me jump in on that. Because I think a real advisor at this point would say, that's great, you're doing asset allocation for me, but what about some of the more human things that I provide?
Yeah, it always sounds so much like somebody trying to convince themselves as much as anything, or a little bit of fear in their voice. So I worked in wealth management with high net worth financial advisors before, and the thing that kept striking me was what percentage of what they do could be done systematically by a computer. And if you think about in books and like my background in behavioral thing, I look at people and I say, we have this brain, this little chunk of meat between our ears, and it takes inputs from our eyes and from our ears. And then it runs little algorithms, then it decides what to do, which are its outputs. You can do a lot of that kind of mimicry of saying, I'm going to talk to a financial planner, and I'm going to say, somebody wants to open an IRA. What do you need to know in order to give them good advice about that? What questions do you ask? How do you use that information, and what's the output? And I would say like version 1.0 of robo-advising is just the picking off of whatever is the lowest hanging fruit that is easiest to do that advisors do. Like say, you know, should I use a Roth or a traditional IRA? How much should I contribute to my 401k? These are things that it is very apparent how you would make this decision and how you give this advice. And I think as people confuse the advice from the distribution mechanism, I think that take good advice, and you can think about like, did the advisor send it over email or did they use an Excel? You know, there are these things that are like the medium through which you give the advice. We effectively just said, we are going to do this through a medium where we can give it to everybody through a website. And we're going to invest heavily in writing the algorithms correctly, knowing what questions we should ask. And then it's simply a matter of, you know, scaling it up very quickly.
So let's talk about, I've just put $100,000 because, hey, let's make up a number, right? You're going to basically do asset allocation for me. Mm-hmm. And you're going to do that based off of a series of questions that I basically answer, right?
Yep.
Are all those solutions and those portfolios straight off the shelf, or are there custom options as well?
So it's interesting. I forget what the number is. There are literally thousands of different end states that you can end up in. The first thing we do is I like to think about, we talk about your circumstances and your goals, where you want to be in the future. So there are facts about you. Let's use, for example, the fact that we're in New York City. Now, if you live in New York City and you're making a pretty serious income, you're going to pay both high federal tax rates and high state and local taxes. So there's an interesting piece of tax information in terms of how you earn and how much you earn that actually feeds through into the investment process, which is that if you're using a taxable account with us, we're probably going to push you towards using New York State municipal bonds because there's so much tax savings in it for you. So one element is who you are, your circumstances. The other element is your future. You know, are we talking about opening up a Roth IRA, a traditional IRA, a taxable account? How much risk should we take? How long should we be investing for? How are you going to withdraw that money? So strangely enough, like the foundation on which the allocation and the advice is built isn't about investments. It's about the investor. And from there, we start thinking about how we can match and tailor the investments to serve the investor. So in this case, you might say, I'm looking to put my kids through college in New York State in a few years. I've already done the 529 element of things. I want to save some more. We would put you into a portfolio that had less risk because it's a short time horizon. And also there would be a higher weighting towards New York State municipal bonds.
So that's like a very specific example. But just how do you think about asset allocation in general on a more meta level?
So we kind of simplify things down to, generally speaking, a stock versus bond allocation. So if you are in our 100% bond allocation, we basically think that means clients say no risk, please. In that case, you are 100% in SHV, which is a ultra short treasury.
That's like putting your money under a mattress.
Exactly.
Basically, right?
Yeah. It is as close as you're going to get to a money market fund in the ETF world.
Which leads to another question, which is everything you guys do ETF?
It is.
So pick up and keep talking about what this basic portfolio looks like from an ETF perspective and how you pick those.
So in every case, we are looking at maximizing the customer's take-home returns. So we generally think that it is unlikely that any fund that is actively managed, and that includes active indices, is going to outperform, or at least there's a really significant headwind. And so we tend to look at funds that have very low expense ratios, that are large and liquid, so that we can buy them and sell them. There's a lot of outstanding interest without the customer paying significant transaction costs. Also where if there is a big move, we as a sort of trader are not going to have a lot of impact on those markets because there are so many other people trading them. So all of it comes down to cost, either the expense ratio of the fund, the bid-ask spread of the fund, the depth of market of the fund. just trying to keep all of those costs, both sort of ongoing and liquidity related, as low as possible.
And for the any international section of the portfolio, what do you use for that? Is it something that is international developed, or something that's total international, or do you ever do single countries?
Great question. So we do, on the stock side, we use our primary ticker, and I'll get back to what I mean by that, is VEA, which is the Vanguard International Developed Fund. I believe it costs something like 8 basis points. And then we also have the International Emerging Market Fund, VWO. And the key there, it's really interesting in the field that it is sometimes cheaper to use more funds than to use just one fund. So our portfolio as a whole costs, I believe, about 9 or 10 basis points once you take into account all of these fund costs. If you were to use the All Country World Index ETF, which is provided by BlackRock, I believe it costs 33 basis points. And they have asset allocation funds that can do similar things.
I think Vanguard has VT.
VT.
That's the whole enchilada, but that's 12.
You're 12.
Right. Yeah,
exactly.
I see. It's interesting. Yeah. So you got cheaper using a couple products instead of the whole enchilada one.
Exactly.
Yeah. Even if it's, even it's Vanguard to boot, which is interesting.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it also allows us to manage risk at different levels. So imagine that you're a customer who comes in with a long time horizon. We give you a 90% stock portfolio. But then as your time horizon gets shorter and shorter, you get closer and closer to needing to spend the money. We want to decrease the risk. We want to be able to change the proportion that VWO, emerging markets, makes up as it. We don't want to be stuck into just one allocation. So there's a level of granularity that allows us to take on more emerging market risk, more small cap value risk at the high end, and we want to be able to tone that down at the low end. So by having these slices, we could go much simpler, but by having these slices, it's actually less expensive to clients, and it gives us more control. The more granular you cut something, the more you can tax loss harvest. And so we actually wanted to have things that were sufficiently unlike each other that we would maximize tax loss harvesting opportunities.
And of course, just a question. We talked about, you talk about VWO. That's the Vanguard Emerging Markets. Now, there is a cheaper one in Schwab. You don't always go for the one that's the cheapest, because you could have a new issuer come out and be, say, zero fees.
Yep.
But you wouldn't necessarily go for that. So is there a liquidity threshold you look at? Like how many shares, what's the volume have to look like for you to buy it?
So I love Mexican food. So we use a measure called the TACO, the total annual cost of ownership, which includes both the expense ratio that the fund charges, but also the cost of getting in and out of the fund, right? So it's a little bit like my parents live on a barrier island, and their house might be really cheap, but it's going to cost you a pretty big toll to get onto that island and take that back.
And the toll in this case is the bid-ask spread, right?
Correct.
Okay. And that's you just put that into percentage terms, and it's usually, and then you put that into the TACO.
Exactly.
Yeah,
okay. Put into the taco and it's healthy and delicious. that measure guides us. And in a lot of cases, a new fund will come out that doesn't have a lot of existing people trading it. It doesn't have very good spreads. And so we'll watch it. This is actually a big part of what we do. We actually revisit what funds we purchase on behalf of clients every quarter. And so every quarter we can say, oh, there's a new fund out here. It has a really good sort of prospectus.
Really,
it's not ready for showtime yet.
Is that a taco party?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So you also have this really unique background because you have an expertise in behavioral science.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that. How did you acquire that?
By being indecisive. So,
well done.
Quick step back. What is behavioral science? I mean, sure. And how does it apply to investing? What is that?
So a lot of the economics and finance profession, when it was really starting out and starting to get very rigorous and empirical, you need to make assumptions about how people behave. And the math is a heck of a lot easier if you assume people are rational and make good decisions and don't have biases. So for years, a lot of models were built up on the idea that, on average, people are kind of smart, or they figure things out and they're not making systematic mistakes. I remember, so I was a sophomore in college, an undergrad, and starting to read some papers about how people made systematic errors in probability or in investing, or how they thought about money, and thinking, you know what, this is really interesting. I think I could like have a career as an academic in it. And then I continued to read and realized that like all of my ideas had already been done in the 1970s by academics. So I realized, actually, I'm going to have some kind of a different career. And the idea of actually applying it in the real world and saying, okay, people think about money differently than economists do. They make specific errors. What are they? And is there an opportunity to help people have better outcomes if we work with them as real human beings rather than as perfectly rational agents? So that's a large part of it, is saying, like, how do people actually make decisions? If they knew better, how would they make decisions, and how do we close the gap between those?
So can I go to an example of this? So, and everybody's wondering about this, when the next market downturn happens, right? Or a correction, or a bear market. Talk about what you would do for clients who are scared and want to sell everything.
Yep. I tend to think that a vaccine is way better than a cure. This is tough. So this is one of the toughest things we struggle with. Generally speaking, we are boring. We are not here to help you outperform. When we talk to you about things, we talk to you about goals and whether or not you're on track to hit goals. And how are you situated today for what you need to achieve in the future? If you log on to your Betterment account, we don't talk about what the market did yesterday or the past month or really at all. We talk to you about, are you on track to hit your goals? And where does it look like you're going to be in 5 years? And is your portfolio drifted? And what should you do about that? So the experience of being a Betterment customer is very different than going to an online brokerage site. And I think that shift of focus from what happened recently to what do I need to know about the future and what can I change, it's a dramatic driver of differences in behavior. So when we use red and green on our site, it has nothing to do with what the market did. It has to do with whether or not you're on track for the future, green, or whether or not you need to take some actions to get back on track. I think part of it is that we get very smart clients too. There's been a number of different pieces of research I've been involved with, or other people have, that clients very strongly self-select to something that is what they want. So if you want gambling and get rich quick, you're going to be in some kind of an easy, low-cost direct brokerage where you get to come in and buy your Apple and sell it and short and do all these silly things. Our customers, we don't have that. You come in and we talk to you about goals and plans and taxes and finance. And we never talk about single stocks. We don't have anything that shows you a single stock that you're invested in. So we have customers who that works for. We have people who are interested in the long run and planning and making smart decisions, not in short-term market timing and picking. So I actually think there's going to be a really interesting sort of shift. People ask what's going to happen. The answer is, number one, I don't need to do too much because the customers who are our customers are already ahead of the game. They're already smart. They know what's going on. We're building interfaces and services in a way that helps reinforce that by helping them focus on the future and not the past. And finally, there is some element. We actually have been through, I think there was a 20% drawdown in early 2016. Every time we have these little, I sort of think of them as dress rehearsals for the big thing, we run small experiments about how much do we, you know, if we do this on our mobile phones, does that help? If we do this kind of intervention on the web app, how effective is it? You know, like, should we use people or should we make it be more anonymous? We're constantly learning and really systematically learning about what works at scale for improving behavior. And it works on our client base.
When you think about that proactivity from your perspective, it's also to fend off disaster, I guess, from a investing standpoint for an investor. What's the single biggest investment mistake that people make?
Oh, it's saving. It is not saving enough, and usually in the right way. So if you're saving in a taxable cash account before you're saving in your 401k where your employer matches, you're literally missing out on 100% returns immediately in a tax-advantaged vehicle. Again, this is where I think what we do is incredibly sexy, because we help you avoid those mistakes that cost you the most money, making sure that you're hitting the company match or that you're using the tax advantage vehicle of your choice, etc. On the other hand, so I think that saving and saving the right amount in the right way and for the right things, like how much do I wish that 5 years ago, future Dan went to like past Dan and said, you're going to have a kid. Like, you are a married 29-year-old guy. You're going to have a kid. Start saving today. That kind of foresight is very valuable. People's biggest mistake is not thinking about their saving in the right way and making it effortful. People like the more that you're not thinking about your saving it, you're doing it anyway, the better you're going to be at it.
So help me better understand my own brain. And what games do you guys play to help me help myself?
Sure. I love this because there's a lot of jobs in life where, like, when you do good at it, people know. And actually, in my job, if I'm really good at it, our clients have no idea that I've kind of, like, Jedi mind tricked them. Which isn't to say I'm being tricky. It's just that it's part and parcel of the experience. So a good example is the use of color. It's not that we don't use color. It's that when we use color, we're going to give you the impression of everything being okay unless it isn't. And red is going to draw your attention to something that you can fix. So if you aren't saving enough, or if your portfolio is drifted and it's something that you need to take care of, that's going to show up red when you log in. And our eyes naturally gravitate to the contrast. You're going to be pulled to that. You're going to spend time, and it's like, I've seen this. It's really annoying to have a little red pop-up on your thing, and you want to resolve it and get it done with. And the resolution of that isn't going to be, you know, buying an Apple. It's going to be figure out how to save $20 more a month, and you'll be fine. Other element of it is kind of making things be interesting or move or attention-grabbing that, again, you can control the outcome of rather than the past. So imagine if you had a weather app that kind of showed you what the weather was the past week. You'd look at it and go, this is the dumbest app in the world. And yet that's what most investing and finance apps are. They're like, it used to be worth more, now it's worth less. And you're like, well, thanks. That's not really useful information. So a lot of our app is focused on, you know, we don't have a crystal ball, but we're pretty sure this is what the future holds, and we're going to give you the kind of guidance that you might want to change your route or add on some more time to your journey.
And do you have anything to appease somebody who just feels like, I got to sell something? Like, is there, I think I recall you at a conference once talking about this, where you let them do a little something to get it out of their system. What's that like?
Absolutely. So the way I think about it is that you never stop a river. You can redirect it. You can use it for irrigation. You can use it to generate electricity, but you're never going to be able to stop the river. So you have to take whatever sort of momentum and real underlying emotional issue that they have and redirect it or make them think about it slightly differently. So a really good example, here's an incredibly irrational thing. People market time in their taxable accounts more than they do in their tax-advantaged accounts. Huh. So you look at your retirement account and you're like, no, that's long-term, I'm not going to touch it. But I'm worried about the election, I think the market's going to go down, so I'm going to market time in my taxable account. This is incredibly dumb. You know, like, the market's going to have an equal impact on both those accounts. But if you market time in your taxable, you're definitely going to end up owing taxes. So what we did is we built a feature called Tax Impact Preview. And what it does is, just for taxable accounts, before you go through with an allocation change, it says, totally fine if you want to do this, but you're going to owe $500 in taxes come April 15th. People don't think about taxes when they're trading. It's hard for them to calculate it, and they hate them. People really hate taxes. So if you throw up there is a sticker price of $500 in tax if you go ahead with this. What we just found is that if that number is more than $50, if they're going to owe more than $50 in taxes, there's less than a 1 in 10 chance that they're going to go ahead with it. So give them something else that they hate more. What do they hate more than losing money? They hate paying it to the government, apparently.
So to bring this back to the ETF, I want to ask you, your average customer, do they know that they're actually investing in ETFs?
I would guess that the average one does, yeah. I would guess that they would have a hard time explaining to you how an ETF was different than a mutual fund and why and so on. But I think they have a general understanding that ETFs are liquid and low cost and track indices, and that's the right way for them to be invested.
Dan, thanks for your time. Can we go have a taco now?
Yeah, okay. I think it's time for a taco party.
Taco party.
Yeah.
Now you're making me hungry.
That was the goal. By the way, is there a taco ETF?
There's a food and beverage ETF with the ticker PBJ, which is pretty good, but I don't. There's probably some taco company in there.
Favorite ticker?
I like Robo. I will have to admit.
Jane.
That seems biased.
That's biased. You guys can count for them. Outside of that.
J-Nug is another.
J-Nug, okay.
That's a good question.
J-Nug, by the way, is probably the most volatile ETF on the planet. It's triple leveraged junior gold miners.
Yep.
I think that's what you're using in your after-tax account.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, is there like the not betterment portfolio?
Oh, that's a really good one. What would be the anti-matter to our portfolio? Yeah, it would be like a triple leveraged short Bitcoin.
Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, and a bunch of other places I probably haven't heard about yet. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm at Joel Weber Show. He's at Eric Balchunas. Trillions is produced by Jordan Bell with help from Magnus Henriksen. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts. Bye.